you come, it's a different experience entirely. People always say, you know, when should I come for ziyarah? Should I come during Arba'in period or during other seasons? But in all honesty, each season has its own benefits, and this time is phenomenal in the sense that the most people visit Karbala at this time, and it's amazing being part of that crowd.
Can you tell a little about differences between this trip and other trips? I'm just talking about the differences between this spiritual journey and other journeys.
Arba'in for me, I think, is mainly in the 3-day walk from Najaf to Karbala. This is a distinct aspect of the Arba'in trip because during this time you have the ability to witness the generosity of the pilgrims for the love of Imam Hussein. You find a lot of service being carried out in his name, and you really understand what the meaning of love is from here. You understand a very humanitarian perspective of Imam Hussein's message because everybody unites under this banner of serving him and loving him for the sake of God and for the sake of humanity. In other seasons, I think you get more of a personal time in the Haram, so you get to visit Abu Fadl alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and it's very private because you can go to the Zari, you can go to the shrine, you can send your salams, you can really pour out your emotion. But in this time, I think it's more a time of unity in the Muslim Ummah. I think it is the world's largest gathering, world's largest peace gathering. So in terms of globalization, it brings together people of all different backgrounds, different nationalities, different creeds, different religions. You'll even see Christians and Sikhs here, which is phenomenal. Even me being a Westerner and being here, people get surprised at the fact that you've come all the way from London to actually display your love for Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. It's truly an honor to be part of this crowd because you feel as if it's also in relation to the 12th Imam. You feel this huge connection with him in this time because the people who are walking are displaying these attributes of one who is literally a servant to him. And to be classified as a servant to him, it's an amazing honor, and you really do feel the benefits of being in the mercy and the generosity of the Ahlul Bayt in this time.
And can you tell our audience why such a thing happened? People try to serve pilgrims of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
I think the love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is so incredible that anybody who falls in love with him wants to not only love him, not only love God, because he died for the path of God and for the path of truth, but you end up falling in love with the principles that he had. Imam Hussein alayhi salam as a person was the most generous person. You find on the day of Ashura, he gave water to the people who he knew were going to kill him and murder him and his family. Even so, they displayed acts of animosity and envy and hatred towards him. He still always replied with love and compassion and mercy to mankind. And even on the day of Ashura, you find that Imam Hussein puts his cheek on the cheek of John the slave, a black man, an African man who's come from various different continents, but Imam Hussein alayhi salam brings him under his army. You also find Umm al-Wahhab, who is the mother of Wahhab, who's also a Christian man who was fasting on the day of Ashura. He wasn't particularly Muslim, he definitely wasn't Shia, but Imam Hussein alayhi salam had this love for him. Similarly, I think in Arba'in time, when you've served the lovers of Imam Hussein, you feel this beauty because it's a connection between you and Allah. You see, even Prophet Isa alayhi salam is somebody that they say in his last supper, he washed the feet of his disciples. He looked after the people who were around him. And he did this as a prophet of Allah to show that humility is a key to reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I think in this time, in the name of Imam Hussein, when people love Imam Hussein, they literally want to love everything to do with him. They want to love each other. They want to love him. They want to love the people who love him. And that's why you say, Inni salmun liman salamakum, I'm at peace with those who are at peace with you. Because you really do fall in love with the entire, the width and the vastness of this love encompasses everybody. Similarly, Imam Hussein is just, it really emphasizes the aspect of service in Islam. Islam is a religion of service. Whether you are a king or you are a poor person, everybody has this aspect of giving and generosity. And Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are known to be the most generous of mankind, and I think this is why we spend our time giving. Just some people here are phenomenal. They literally spend their entire year saving up money just so they can buy things just to give out to the Zawar and the pilgrims. It really puts your life into perspective, especially as a Westerner, because you feel as if we can be so selfish in our lifestyles. We can be very focused on the materialism of our own lifestyles. But you come here and you see people who give away everything that they have for the sake of Abu Abdullah. It really is a lesson of humility above all, and it's amazing to be a part of it.
Thank you. And the last question, what do you want from Imam Hussein alayhi salam?
Imam Hussein alayhi salam, I think if he ever looked at me as his servant, I think I would have accomplished in life, because I never want to have the arrogance to say that I'm a servant of Hussein, but I pray that in his eyes he sees me as that, because as a human being, there's nothing more that you want than to be in the realms of their mercy and actually encompass the values that they had. If I can, by the end of my life, say that I've lived a life in the service of Hussein, because from him I learn how to love, I learn how to give, I learn the meaning of truth, I learn the meaning of justice, I learn the meaning of equality in mankind. If I can encompass these values in my own lifestyle, I'd say that I'm a person who died successful. And like Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Fustu wa Rabbil Ka'aba," they die with a certainty that they died in the path of Allah. If I can die with that message in the name of Hussein, with the love of Hussein, I feel as if I will be successful. And this is why ziyarah is so important. I've been coming on ziyarah since I was about 6 years old, 7 years old. And every time I come, I build on this relationship between me and my imam. When you have the ability to build on your relationship, you realize that they're not people who are dead, they are alive. So when you visit them, they are literally your teacher. They can be a scholar. They can be somebody who gives to you, somebody who teaches you, somebody who loves you. And when they do that, you realize that this connection is so alive that there's nothing, no one is more alive than Imam Hussein in my life. So for me, he is the biggest inspiration, biggest role model in my life to become like him in the service of him. And inshallah, that's what I pray for myself and everybody else who's also present here in Arba'in in Karbala.
Inshallah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Hope you have instilled in our heart in a world where hopes disappear. Peace you have ingrained in our soul in a time when peace becomes rare. Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein plan to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred ring. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
I want to talk to a pilgrim of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Salam alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
What's your name, sir?
Muhammad Ali.
Where do you come from?
Germany.
So you're German. How many times have you been to Karbala on Arba'in?
2 times. It's my second time now.
Okay, did you get here on food?
Everywhere. So you get food everywhere.
No. Did you get here? Did you walk to Karbala from Najaf?
Yes, we walked.
Can you talk a little about the atmosphere on the way to Karbala?
It's a nice experience, and a lot of people, and you meet many people.
Don't you want to talk about the Iraqis' hospitality? That is the way they treated you?
And you say, like, they love guests, and if you need something, they also let you come into your house if you want, for example, to take a shower. They open the doors for you. Yeah, they give, and they invite you to eat, and they love guests.
How does this journey differ from other journeys?
So it depends from the spiritual atmosphere and many people, friendly people, and it's very crowded, and it's amazing how crowded it is, how many people come, and how many people like to join in this spiritual atmosphere.
What makes people walk such a long distance toward Imam Hussein alayhi salam?
the love to Imam Hussein, to Ahl Bayt, and remembering the Islamic resistance.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask you about a thing you will want from God under the dome of Imam Hussein alayhi salam?
The unity of all Muslims, of Shia and Sunni Muslims, and of all races and nations, and guidance of my family who are all non-Muslims. And victory of Palestine, of the people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Burma, Central Africa, everywhere.
We hope so. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Dear listeners, thanks for being with us. For now, bye.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
September the 22nd marks the anniversary of the Iraq-Iran War of 1980, when Iran found itself isolated against the aggressor Saddam Hussein, who had a world behind him. But the day is matched by the National Day of Defense Industry, marked on August the 22nd this year. That's a healthy antidote to a bitter memory the country is determined not to see anytime soon. With over 40 years of sanctions, including 8 years of war, Iran understood the importance of military independence. But how deterring is our military program, and is it economically justified? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Military self-sufficiency for survival is a mantra set deep in the Iranian psyche. How Iran has gone about attaining self-sufficiency is by indigenizing defense technologies and benefiting from talented youth's manpower in the armed forces. Much attention has been paid to creating and expanding a missile arsenal. Mr. Kortari is an MP and retired IRGC commander. He shared his experiences with us in Parliament, where we went to meet him. Why has this country focused so much on missiles?
If we didn't have it, they would have certainly destroyed us. You need to act with power against bullies and aggressors. There's no room for a negotiation with someone who doesn't understand the language of logic. Look at Afghanistan. They admitted to killing children under the pretext of targeting Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists. They don't understand anything. They believe everything has to be in their interests. But that couldn't be any further from the truth. God has created everyone equal.
Mr. Khoshchesham is a senior political analyst and familiar face on Press TV. He joined us on Skype this time.
Threats, military threats against Tehran are now part of the U.S. Strategy, permanent strategy, in order to subdue Tehran. Therefore, they have left Tehran with no other choice but to reinvigorate itself, especially considering that Iran has been under toughening sanctions, and many war powers have defied helping Iran with military tools and equipment, therefore forcing Tehran to develop its arms program, which actually started during the eight-year-long war imposed by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, when Iran was not even provided by, the most simple weapons and tools. When Iran intended to import barbed wires, they never allowed Iran, and they confiscated two trucks, alongside borders of CIS countries in the north of Iran, and Iran was under tough sanctions during the eight-year-long war.
The missile program is the cornerstone of Iranian defense strategy and deterrence. It emerged after Iran acquired the art of reverse engineering missiles it had acquired from different sources. Effective deterrence capability should be economic justification enough for the missile program.
During Operation Khaybar in 1984, in the Talaye area, the 27th Division was commanded by Haji Ibrahim Hemmat, who was martyred during the same operation. He was a teacher before the Islamic Revolution and used to run away from Savak. He was under considerable pressure there, as there were many injured and martyrs, and the Iraqis were repelling their attacks. It got to a point where Hassan Tehrani Mogaddam, known as the father of Iran's missile program, who was a student at the time, got to the front line. He used to monitor the news and knew that we were under tremendous pressure there. I was helping Haji Ahmad, who was the commander. Tehrani Mogaddam promised to bring in a missile and target the Iraqi's fortifications so we could advance. The next morning, he brought a Toyota with a metal beam welded on the back and a missile on top. He fired a missile, which flew about 4 meters and landed in front of the Toyota. We were shocked by what happened and asked him what went wrong. He said, "I make missiles." That was in 1984. He resolutely continued his work and made better missiles later.
Thanks to the U.S. drones, sophisticated drones like RQ Sentinel 160, 170, Scan-Eagle, MQ-4, MQ-9, or Reaper, all other types, different types of U.S. Sophisticated drones that Iran has hunted and brought down and reverse engineered and reproduced all of them, Iran is now able to, it has actually manufactured different kinds of drones, very advanced drones that are radar evading. Iran has developed the needed geometrical shape, the coating, the structure and the texture of the body and the wings that are needed. These are different systems used for radar evading aircraft and drone. And Iran has developed this technology through reverse engineering the captured U.S. drones. Iran is now equipped with the most sophisticated drone technology, and the CENTCOM commander of the United States said just a few weeks ago that they have lost superiority in the Middle East because of the U.S. drone, because of Iranian drones in the region.
Sanctions against armed forces in Iran and the defense industry are not new. The Air Force, a conventional force, has also been subject to harsh sanctions for many years. Where negotiations for sanctions lifting might fail, Iran turns to neutralizing sanctions by boosting its industry. It's not just arms and missiles. Communications networking is itself a power factor in modern wars. And the Ministry of Defense boasted in August that it had managed to localize communications networks in the country. Presently, we have established fair cooperation and collaboration with 600 academic centers and 900 knowledge-based companies in line with meeting demands of the armed forces in relevant fields. This, the chief executive of Electronic Industries Organization of the Ministry of Defense said. That's Brigadier General Shahrukh Shahram. Iran's military history is as old as global civilization itself. This country is known to have created the world's first empire 2,500 years ago, a benevolent empire. And so, it's perfectly aware of the importance of arms. But given Iran's position in the world of today and the fact that it's ruled by religious doctrine, makes it care more for defense, rather defense and deterrence. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said that the policy of the armed forces is to increase the ability to attack the centers of threats. His statement released on the occasion of the anniversary of National Day of Defense Industry read, "Increasing the ability to attack the centers of threat against the Islamic country is a strategic, unstoppable policy of the armed forces." As a soldier during the war, to what extent did you feel the lack of equipment?
It was so severe, both in terms of weapons and ammunition. We would take most of them from Iraqis themselves because they were backed by dollars coming from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and Kuwait. Our personnel would cover their shortages from them. Syria was the only country that sold us weapons until the very end of the war. Although Libya worked with us in the first 3-4 years, and North Korea sold us weapons in the last 3-4 years.
The Islamic Republic believes it has aimed straight for military self-sufficiency, looking at its achievements in strengthening foundations of the resistance front, as well as expanding its defense capability beyond Iranian borders. Its armed forces and defense sector can be taken as a centerpiece of security and stability in the region. Iranian commanders believe the country's military self-sufficiency has reached such a level that the courage to attack Iran doesn't exist. The accuracy of Iranian missiles in attacking, say, ISIS can serve as proof. The IRGC, or Revolution Guard Corps, launched a permanent aerospace fair showcasing ballistic missiles in September 2020. I will go on to 2021 as well. There it unveiled its third-generation naval strike ballistic missile. It showcased the Zulfaqar-e-Basir missile with a range of more than 700 kilometers as its new-generation ballistic missile. The newest projectile is fitted with a warhead that is guided by an optical seeker head. The country has deployed Zulfaqar-e-Basir against overseas targets, such as gatherings of the terror group Daesh, as well as the United States' Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. That was targeted after the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top anti-terror general. Other capabilities demonstrated in the exhibition were UAVs, satellites, defense systems, reconnaissance apparatus, and electronic warfare, as well as some of the invading drones that were shot down by the Corps in the past, including American and Israeli ones. More on military equipment and missiles after a quick diversion into world media. To have a look at what other outlets have to say, I invite you indoors. And here's how they word it. We've got Tasnim news and an expression of determination. Iran's new defense minister vows to build up IRGC's military power. The new defense minister of Iran pledged that his ministry will do its utmost to boost the capabilities of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. In a meeting with the IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami in Tehran, Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani reaffirmed the defense ministry's full support for all armed forces of the country, highlighting the need for a revolutionary approach in the military sector coupled with the continuation of the previous efforts The general said the defense ministry will employ all of its capacities to deepen and boost the defense capabilities and fulfill the needs of the armed forces, specifically the IRGC, including by supplying modern and strategic systems and equipment. Brigadier General Ashtiani stressed that coordination, synergy, and convergence among Iranian military units will ensure the fulfillment of the strategic needs of the armed forces and strengthening of the defense power. Tehran Times tells of an unprecedented show of military capability. Iran sets foot in backyard of the U.S. Now, with a serious test of Iran's naval capability for a long-term mission in distant waters, Iran has set its feet in the backyard of the Americans in the North Atlantic Ocean or any other body of water in the world. The 75th Naval Fleet of the Army, consisting of Makran Big Ship and Sahan Destroyer, finally entered the territorial waters of Iran in the past few days after 133 days of navigation and 44,000 kilometers of sea route in the most unprecedented mission in the history of Navy of Iran's army and docked in Bandar Abbas. What sets this mission distinct from its previous 74 missions is not only the long without docking journey along the route, but also Iran's first presence in the North Atlantic, which has always been considered the backyard of the United States, Britain, and France. That would be it for the news section, but do stay tuned. More of the program coming up.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's ballistic missile systems, supplemented by cruise missiles and UAVs, are intended for deterrence but can be used for battle. This is complemented by asymmetric warfare tactics. Israel may have over 200 nuclear warheads, but their troops on the ground wouldn't have much to say for themselves. Look at its recent war with Lebanon. Anyhow, not yet fully provoked, Iran has kept its ballistic missiles down at a range limit of 2,000 kilometers. Its priority is to improve precision rather than increase range, notable in several missile systems. Say, the Qiyam-1 is an 800-kilometer range variant of the Shahab-2 short-range ballistic missile with a 500-kilogram separable warhead and ground-based guidance augmentation. A modified version of the Qiyam, which appears to have a maneuverable re-entry vehicle to further improve its accuracy, was used in the January 2020 attack against Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. The MARD is based on the longer-range Qad-1 variant of the Shahab-3 medium-range ballistic missile and has claimed a range of 1,800 kilometers. It is also equipped with a separating MARV. The Rode Mobile solid-fuel short-range ballistic missiles of the Fateh family have evolved both in range and in accuracy. They have evolved in range from about 300 kilometers to a claimed 1,400 kilometers and in accuracy by means of the incorporation of terminal guidance, including an anti-ship version.
The system, third of Khordad, is so popular now among the world armies that they have requested Iran to supply them with this kind of air defense shield. and also the missile Sayyad that was used to bring down that aircraft is now requested by some countries. Some of these systems have been, you know, taken to Syria and deployed in there in order to be integrated into the Syrian air defense shield now. So Iran has spread and developed its air defense points from a few to 3,000 now. And in the near future, Iran plans to increase it to 5,000 to 6,000 points. So there is no place left, you know, in Iran that could be targeted by anyone, by any kind of aircraft. The Iranian radars and air defense shields can identify targets from a range of 3,000 kilometers away as soon as they, you know, start flying.
The Fateh family also shows the important strides Iran has taken in solid propellant missiles. Their advantage is because of their launch preparation time, which is much shorter. Iran's long-term missile development priorities will focus on missiles powered by solid propellants. Those overcome the operational and performance limitations of the country's liquid propellant systems. The emphasis on precision, together with the move towards solid propellants, is combined clearly in the Fateh family of short-range ballistic missiles. The country is having rolled out three new Fateh variants, Zulfaqar, Dezful, and Haj Qasem, over only 4 years is a remarkable development. If prevention is better than cure, deterrence comes before defense. And Iran is continuing to develop and introduce armed UAVs and cruise missiles. UAVs being unmanned aerial vehicles.
Iran has built warships, destroyers, it's working on submarines. The Navy commanders say if the country feels the need for long-distance deployment, then they are very much able to even produce aircraft carriers.
Major General Hossein Salami of the IRGC said, "We can hit moving targets in the ocean from the heart of our land. That would mean targeting aggressive aircraft carriers and warships by long-range ballistic missiles. It is usual to hit moving targets in the sea by low-speed cruise missiles. But using long-range missiles is a great defense breakthrough for us because we can hit moving targets in the ocean from the heart of our land," he said. Military self-sufficiency is warranted by having your own military equipment, but you've also got to have your own people to strategize and put the equipment to use. Missiles aside, another crucial dimension of Iran's defenses is its asymmetric war doctrine that aims to avoid direct confrontation with the enemy by using surprise and deception and creating a complex battlefield to make sustainable operations difficult for the adversary. This asymmetric or mosaic defense doctrine in Iran was evolved by 2005, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when Iran saw the U.S. practically on its own doorstep. Since 2012, Iran has been adding an offensive dimension by adopting hybrid warfare. Known as the forward defense doctrine, it recommends fighting opponents off outside Iran's borders before they get too close.
What the United States is Iran's arch foe. Israel is another arch foe. And they are armed to the teeth. When Iran started its arms development program, it was under sanctions. Nobody helped Iran. Iran was not able to produce even mortars or bullets or individual arms, sophisticated arms for soldiers decades ago. While the Americans had they enjoyed the most sophisticated arms that any power or any country could have. So Iran was thinking of how it can defuse the threats of Israel and the United States in the shortest time possible. And then they went after asymmetrical warfare. And they developed asymmetrical warfare techniques, tactics, and gradually it became a doctrine.
Pre-revolution in the 1970s, Iran was undergoing a massive modernization program under the Shah. Its armed forces were being equipped with mostly American and British manufactured equipment. But with the revolution, orders or deliveries were cancelled by Western suppliers.
قبل از انقلاب خب اینطور بود که
It appeared that before the Islamic Revolution, the US and Europe would provide Iran with whatever weapons and arms we wanted. But the reality was that the Iranian military personnel couldn't use the equipment and weapons that much. We saw they couldn't do anything against the Iranian people. They didn't have much capability to fight the enemies either. As we have seen throughout history, including under Reza Pahlavi's rule during World War II, the British invaded Iran from the south, the Russians from the north, and Iran's military didn't put up much resistance.
Iran did not have to rebuild its defense capabilities entirely from scratch, but it required strategic redirection. That would be to apply the revolutionary ideals of independence and self-reliance to defense. The problems of military dependence can be demonstrated by referring to the recent events in Afghanistan. When American maintenance services to the Afghan army were cut off, it could no longer use the world's most advanced fighters and helicopters. Many of these weapons are unused in Afghanistan today. Also, fighter jets delivered to Arab countries are in the same situation and cannot be used without U.S. permission and guidance. The billions of dollars the U.S. and NATO spent on the Afghan military, on training and equipping it, could not fix major internal flaws. And on August the 15th, the Taliban simply captured the Afghan capital, Kabul, and announced the war in Afghanistan is over.
Finally, I want to say that the same situation persists in Afghanistan today. The Americans stationed their troops in Afghanistan, and according to their estimates, paid $2 trillion for establishing a so-called peace. However, the main objective wasn't to empower Afghanistan, but to establish a base for them in an area between China, Russia, India, and Iran to keep an eye on them.
In Iran, pre-1979, Mohammad Reza Shah, the king, paid up front for his whopping load of military equipment. But even that was denied Iran after the revolution. Not just that, here's what happened to thousands of tanks bought from Britain. Iran had paid for them in the 1970s, but they were sold on to Iraq. So during the war of the 1980s, Iran was turned on by its own tanks, basically. Also, Iran's Air Force had to learn how to keep its large fleet of US-built aircraft and helicopters operational single-handedly. And so this country began establishing its own aerospace industry.
Also, Iran has developed its own fourth-generation aircraft for combat and for surveillance as well as training. This has happened through a self-sufficiency plan and move. Also, Iran has made a conceptual model of fifth-generation aircraft. That's the most modern aircraft in the world. There are only 10 types of fifth-generation aircraft, and the Iranian one is the fifth one. Of course, it's the conceptual model. But the most important feature in this kind of aircraft is their radar evading feature.
Former Iranian Defense Minister Brigadier General Hatami stated, "Today, we have gained various achievements in different fields, which are not limited to ground combat. And in the field of missiles, we are undoubtedly one of the world powers. And in the field of unmanned armed vehicles, we are even better than the world's top powers. The main focus of our activity is to gain access to strategic weapons in all areas. That would be all areas excluding dirty weapons." The founder of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, frequently condemned WMDs and especially chemical weapons, the kind that killed thousands upon thousands of Iranians during the eight-year war with Iraq. That'll be all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Bye for now.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
Here's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. wherever you are, whatever time of day, as your heart is mourning and burning in the love for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, I pray that Allah accepts and rewards your tears, and may you always be on the path of Aba Abdullah and his household. Today, we're going to be discussing a very interesting topic. In the studio with me, I have two special guests, as always. Brother Yasser, salamu alaikum.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you for being with us. Brother Abdullah, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for being with us. What makes it interesting today's discussion? What was the objective and reason behind Aba Abdullah's uprising and movement, right? People talk about this every year, all year long. And there's so much to talk about that this show, I'm sure, would not be repetitive. But what makes it interesting is I want you guys, if you can, Sayyidina, if you don't mind starting, put it in your own words through your own personal understanding. Imagine me and Brother Yasser, well, me. Imagine I have no knowledge about this, about Aba Abdullah, what he did and why he did it. If you were to explain it to me in your own words, how would you put it?
Trying to summarize the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, I can begin with one word, awareness. Trying to bring awareness to why we exist in the first place. Once you're aware of who you are, right, and then Imam Hussein alayhi salam's ultimate message was to recognize the time that you live in and the people of the time that you live in. Right. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, when he came, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran did not say he came to preach the oneness of Allah. He did not came to preach monotheism in the sense that it is monotheism, because people believed in Allah before that, except they had a bit of partners to him, right? They had came to shirk. Even Allah says, if you ask him who would create the heavens, who would create this, they would say Allah. So they had no idea in believing in the entity of Allah. But they had a problem believing and accepting the Prophet himself as a messenger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the people weren't aware of their own time and the Imam of their time. Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi wanted to create that kind of awareness, that be aware of your time and the people of your time. Who are you following? Who are you going after? Who's feeding you knowledge? Who's feeding you this? Who's taking your hand right, left, and center? Once you have this sense of awareness, then things become a lot clearer. When we live under or in a circumstance or in a society or environment where our minds are covered and our senses are covered and everything covered, then we will be misguided. But once we pause and we have that kind of awareness and we figure out the people of our time, the imams of our time, the leaders of our time, what's happening around us, then you become, you get that shock. It's like, okay, where am I going? Where am I heading? What is this world? What is this? You know, so you start to question a lot of questions.
So you think Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, what he did was a wake-up call?
It was, nevertheless, was one of the things, obviously, because I can't limit it. But one of them was a wake-up call. For example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his movement began with him and Yazid, having that kind of, if I can use the word, feud, right? When he had that kind of thing with Yazid, he was trying to tell people, okay, there's a tyrant, okay? What you need to do is not only identified as a tyrant, but you need to stand against him. Where you see in the camp of Yazid, where the army that was against Imam Hussein, they knew exactly who Imam Hussein was.
They identified.
They said to him, yes, you are the son of Rasulullah. Yes, you are more legitimate than Yazid. Yes, you are wearing his turban. Yes, you have his sword. Yes, you are the Imam. But we have to follow Yazid. So he had no problem identifying the Imam himself, but their minds and their mentality was at the wrong place. So the Imam alayhi salam was trying to say to people, look, once you figure out who you are, where you are, who you're standing against, so it's not a matter of identifying tyrants, because sometimes we have brothers who, where I come from, the West, where we have brothers, they know that the West or the country, or at least the government, are corrupted, are against Muslims, killing Muslims in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria. They know that. But then I don't mind taking part of that government. I don't mind being a soldier. I don't mind being a police officer. I don't mind giving them support in a way or another.
Using the assets to my own advantage.
They can identify who the tyrants are. But when it comes to their stand, it's a different issue.
Right.
So سيوفنا عليك وقلوب لنا معك. Our swords are against you, but our hearts with you. Our swords against you. Mm. So Imam Hussein wanted to break, get that wake up call. Mm. Realize who you are, where you stand, the time you are in, and the imams of the people of your time that are running the show.
That's an interesting look on it. I, like you said, obviously the event of Karbala and the movement of Abu Abdullah is so multifaceted and it's so comprehensive and complex, yet so simple in its essence. Mm. You know, as always, it's the fight between truth and falsehood, haq and batil. Brother Yasser, if you were to explain in your own words what was the philosophy and reason of Imam al-Hussein's movement from how you saw it, what would it be?
Say, put it quite nicely, if you want to explain it to somebody who doesn't have a background of religion or history or anything else, and the awareness of yourself, the awareness of around you. If you want to go further and look at the events that happened after Ashura, after the 10th of Muharram, we see that awareness in the larger Muslim population actually happening mm-hmm. with the events that occurred afterwards, with the, for example, the Tawabin or those who, as they call them, the repenters, for example, even though that's not a very accurate word for them. Or, for example, the uprising of the people of Medina that resulted in the Battle of Harra, for example.
The massacre.
No, it wasn't even a battle, it was a siege.
Exactly.
And other events that happened till today.
Mm.
You know, all of that awareness kind of filtered down to today. So that was a very good way of putting it. Another one could be that if you had to explain to somebody, it's not only awareness of the social aspects, but also of yourself. Who are you? What is your relationship in terms of your existence on this planet? You know, if you see something being done, what is your responsibility in that? Are you supposed to go out and fight or not? As I say, also mentioned about the governments, we have examples throughout the world, people doing that. And another one that I know most people also mention, and I know you've mentioned this before, is the concept of love, of that, you know, I love something so much that I'm willing to give everything for it.
Beautiful.
You know, there is something that is not material, and, you know, even though, again, if you look at the statements of the Imam alayhi salam, the statements of some of his companions, the statements of his family members, and so on and so forth, on the traveling towards Karbala, the night, especially the night of Ashura is something else. I mean, this night or that evening before the day of Ashura, that itself is, you know, something that volumes can be written on. If you had to look at the statements that were made, and the concept of love, the concept of, you know, affection, and the ability to give everything for that which you love. So this is one of the things that maybe I would try and focus on.
And then what? I mean, Abu Abdullah set an example of giving everything for what you love. How does that have anything to do with us?
That if we then claim to love Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, then we should also love that which he loves.
Mm. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
Oh, shahidan to ya Hussein. آه ار سر خانه تو یا حسین آه دلم اسرت کربلا آه کربلا کربلا کربلا
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to Back to Reality. Here in the studio, we're discussing the concept about Abu Abdullah, what he did and why he did it.
Once you feel the love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because for any human being, we kind of move with love first. If you have love for something, and it just kind of self-drives you towards something. So if you have, for example, you've seen a lot of Christians, you've seen a lot of atheists who got in love with Imam Hussein. Forget Islam. They're not Muslims, nothing. They got in love with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they moved towards Imam Hussein and the message of Imam Hussein itself. So that love itself became a drive for them. Or, for example, George Diop, the guy who wrote The Voice of Human Justice, you know, about Imam Ali alayhi salam. He wasn't a Muslim, he was a Christian. But the love for Ali alayhi salam it drove him crazy. Or like John, he said, you know, حب الحسين أجنني, like the love of Hussein made me crazy. So love itself sometimes is a factor to move people towards the truth, for example, to awaken.
But does all love do that, Sayyid? Does all love do that?
Yeah.
Or do we have to classify love into love that is just a love that is an affection? Or is it a type of love that is more deeper? And that's different from the one that's just an affection. Like these people, we can say it's not love, it's an affection. They're attached to these individuals because of what they stood for. That is not love. Love is something else. What hub and ishq are two different things than just, for example, you know, an affection, a
love
liking.
Love and infatuation.
An infatuation.
Yeah.
It's different. So there's classify or divide. That, you know, there are some individuals, when it comes, they like the message of Imam Hussein. But there are those who act upon, for example, we look at this particular country, for example, Imam Khomeini loved Imam Hussein. There's no doubt about it.
Yep.
And that love, that is true love. That true love drove him to do something because he saw not the Imam, but the principles behind the Imam. That is what
And
I'm
God
to
knows
to.
That he loves Imam al-Hussein because of the principles
exactly.
behind, right?
Imam is the means to those principles.
Yeah. For which Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because if I were to explain it, why did Imam Hussein do what he did, I'd say that he did it on a personal level and like a public, general, collective scale. On a collective scale, he did it to guide mankind, to do Amr bil Ma'ruf, Nahi anil Munkar, to revive the religion of his grandfather, to, you know, be a beacon of guidance for all human beings. But on his personal scale, obviously he did it because he loves Allah, right? And that is how a lot of the scholars interpreted that, oh, why is Imam al-Hussein so special now? Because he gave everything he had for the sake of Allah, and naturally Allah would give everything for Imam al-Hussein. I understand Imam al-Hussein's love for Allah. I understand my love for Imam al-Hussein. I understand how it affects my life. But how can someone who doesn't necessarily see Imam al-Hussein as the Imam, as the Hujjah, as this infallible person, like, say, a Sunni person, right? How can they have that love for Imam al-Hussein without acknowledging his position? How does that work?
It's simple, but once they get to understand what Imam Hussein went through and the concepts that he was trying to uphold, then it's easy to fall in love with. For example, as a human beings, we are naturally drawn to heroes. We're drawn to people who are generous. We are drawn to people who are, I don't know, God-fearing, and so on and so on. So anyone with good traits, we're drawn to them. But these are concepts by themselves. But when you come to me, for example, I don't know Brother Yasser, right? I've never seen him, never heard of him, nothing. You come to me, say to me, there's a brother. Well, that's a point. His name is Yasser. That's 2 points. So I'm trying to build my imaginary around Yasser. You say to me, he's generous, he's brave, he's this, he's that. And all of a sudden, that this brother Yasser that I've never known, I find myself inclined to move towards him. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for example, just a name. You say to a Sunni, he says, yeah, he's from the Ahlul Bayt. You say to him, well, Hussein stood for freedom. Hussein stood for justice. Hussein stood for this. Hussein stood for that. And all of a sudden, you feel that this person feelings like pour towards Imam Hussein.
What Sayyid mentioned is correct, that the human fitrah is naturally drawn towards goodness, beauty, truth.
Yep.
Three things. These three things are always what the human body is, or human soul, or the fitrah, whatever you want to call it, is drawn towards. Truth, goodness, and beauty. And all of that you can see in all the Imams, and explicitly in the mission of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. One of the things that we have, and something that I first speak to myself, is that we destroy that fitrah because of our deeds. We lack the ability to see truth. We lack the ability, or rather we lessen the ability to see truth, the ability to see beauty, and the ability to see goodness. Therefore, it is possible that because of our own actions and our own destruction of our own souls, by our own deeds, we don't see. What is important is that the scholars of ethics don't say that this is ever destroyed. It is always there.
Thank you so very much, brothers, and thank you to our listeners for joining us on today's discussion. I hope you found it beneficial and interesting. Until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Derdimin derdi
شهیدان تو یا حسین، آه هر سرخان تو یا حسین، آه
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
In Germany, flying insects have declined by 76% in 26 years. In the United Kingdom, common butterfly populations have fallen by 46% since 1976. We should all be alarmed by this insect apocalypse. We now present you an article written by Dave Goulson, a professor of biology at the University of Sussex in England. The piece is titled, Insects Are Vanishing from Our Planet at an Alarming Rate. But there are ways to help them. Insects have been around for more than 400 million years. Their ancestors crawling from the oceans to colonize the land long before dinosaurs appeared. They have been enormously successful, evolving into a staggering diversity of more than 1 million known species, with perhaps as many as another 4 million yet to be described by science. There are more than 300,000 different types of beetle alone. I have been obsessed by insects for all of my life. They are amazing, are often beautiful, and lead fascinating and peculiar lives. What's more, the world would not function without these tiny creatures. They pollinate our plants, they control pests, recycle all sorts of organic material from dung to corpses, tree trunks and leaves, keep the soil healthy, disperse seeds, and much more. They're a vital source of food for many larger creatures such as birds, bats, lizards, amphibians, and fish. It should thus be of deep concern to all of us that insects appear to be disappearing from the earth at an alarming rate. In Germany, flying insects have declined by 76% in just 26 years. In the United Kingdom, our more common butterfly populations have fallen by 46% since 1976. And the rarer ones, by 77% despite great efforts to protect them by conservationists. 13 bee species in the United Kingdom have gone extinct, and more will probably follow. In the United States, the celebrated monarch butterfly, famed for its annual migration between Mexico and Canada, has declined by more than 80% since the 1980s. The monarch butterfly population west of the Rockies is down 99.9% in the last couple of decades and looks headed for extinction within a year or two. I vividly remember my parents, when I was a child, having to stop the car on long summer journeys to scrub clear the windscreen, which quickly became crusted with splattered insect corpses as we drove. Today, our windscreens are disturbingly clean. The data is patchy, since many insects are not carefully monitored. But the data we do have almost all points to a rapid, ongoing collapse of insect populations around the world. This mass disappearance has happened within our lifetime, on our watch. The causes of insect declines are many. Loss of habitat to intensive farming, housing and other developments, the ever-growing blizzard of pesticides used by farmers and gardeners, the climate crisis, light pollution, the effects of invasive species, and much more. Our tidy, pesticide-infused world is hostile to most insect life, save for the toughest, most adaptable species, such as cockroaches, mosquitoes, and houseflies. This may all seem terribly depressing, but do not despair. We feel helpless in the face of many global environmental problems, but we can all get involved